Today on Against the Grain, the authoritarianism of the Trump regime calls out for mass radical organizing. But with some exceptions, much of the left has not mounted a coherent response. Journalist Arun Gupta reflects on lessons from the last quarter century, from the global justice movement to Occupy Wall Street, from the George Floyd protest to the Palestine Solidarity Movement, from the primary victory of Zohran Mamdani to immigrant communities' militant resistance to ICE deportations. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Whether it's federal troops on American city streets, demonstrations in the millions, or social media-driven mobilizations, it's easy to see this moment of heightened peril as exceptional. But Arun Gupta reminds us that today's forms of mobilization against the forces of reaction and genocide have been shaped by decades of organizing, some of it powerful and some of it wanting. Arun Gupta was co-founder of The Independent and the Occupied Wall Street Journal. In the latest issue of the Socialist Register, he looks at the Palestine Solidarity Movement through the lens of the last 25 years of left mobilization. Arun, to start with, can you trace for us, in broad brushstrokes, the different ways the left has organized during different times over the course of the 20th and 21st centuries?
So I think we look at both the relationship between who is the agent and then what is the space in which they're organizing. So kind of in an earlier industrial era, specifically really pre-electronic media or just as electronic media is beginning, what you have is worker-based movements, and they're worker-based movements of all sorts. They could be anarchists, they could be communists, they could be socialists, they could be nativist trade unions, but the centrality is it is a working class struggle. Now, that doesn't mean these are the only struggles, but worker struggles were really the center of all left politics for the first 40, 50 years of the 20th century. And we're largely talking about the West and the U.S. Obviously, the Global South is a very different story. And the workers were organized largely in their neighborhoods. And so in terms of that, you're talking especially a lot of immigrant groups. And so they shared a lot of commonalities, sometimes religion, but often there wasn't religious aspects to it, right? When you're talking about, say, the Jewish ghetto in the Lower East Side in the early 1900s, where you had about 1.5 million Jews coming over from East Europe and Russia, a lot of them were not at all religious. They shared political affinities, but they lived together, they worked together, and they also created culture together. And I think this is phenomenally important to understand as to why these were such powerful movements, and in reflection today, why we don't have these really just kind of dense militant movements. You know, they had their own theaters, bookstores, cafes, music venues. They were creating all their own culture. And so this creates these like dense webs that bond people together, where their lives are all lived in relation to each other. Then post-World War II, with the rise of television, as an important, as the dominant communications medium. Obviously, you have radio and film before that, but television, it gets into the home. And I remember once reading this article about a union labor organizer bemoaning that by the early 1950s, how hard it was to get workers to come to meetings at the basically the labor temple, as they were often called, the labor hall, because they wanted to go home and watch puppets on TV. And I think what he was referring to was this show called Kukla, Fran, and Ollie. That aired in the 1950s in the US. And so you start to see kind of how workers are being remade completely as consumers, that their relationship, not just to the market, of course, under capital, they're a commodity, but now they are becoming consuming agents. And it creates this passivity, it creates this atomization. At the same time, the television opens up a new avenue for a new type of politics, which is more identity based. And we especially start to see it with the civil rights movement, Martin Luther King and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. But then you see it start to replicate itself into other areas, such as the movement against nuclear power, second wave feminism, and Betty Friedan, the movement that, kind of the anti-militarism. The doctor, Benjamin Spock, was a leading figure. And so what you have are these charismatic figures that are able to essentially use television as a platform. It's a very constraining medium, but they're able to get their message out. They're able to basically unify a base around the issue and to help essentially shape national and international politics. That doesn't mean they control or dominate it, but that they become this voice in this new medium, right? But the thing is, the kind of the bonds are not as strong. Certainly in the black community, the church was a locus of a lot of this political activity, and so it did create a bond. But a lot of African Americans are secular, and so you had different political forms, such as the Black Panther Party. And we can say, like, looking back from today, that they were maybe pioneers of the third form, the modern form, that they created viral content. So they did it through their 10-point party program, but also kind of dramatic scenes, such as showing up to the California State House in Sacramento with rifles. And that's one of those funny moments where suddenly the NRA is all in favor of gun control when a bunch of black men peacefully show up with guns at the state capitol. And so for decades, through the 70s, 80s, even into the 90s, this is the kind of form of organizing where you have these charismatic leaders, you have a mass of organizations that are more kind of diffuse. They're based on identity or an affinity of a certain politics, environmentalism, feminism, queer politics start to come to the fore, and especially in these latter decades. And then by the late 90s and early 2000s, you see kind of the last iteration of these tendencies. One is the horizontalist anarchist kind of outbreak in 1999 with the Battle of Seattle, the shutdown of the World Trade Organization ministerial. This interjects kind of a new form of politics. And then a few years later, post 9/11, you get the various anti-war movements that tend to be based on traditional peace and social justice organizations, as well as the Marxist left. A lot of people don't realize this, even those who were heavily involved in the movement against the Iraq War, but every single significant anti-war formation was led by Leninist or Trotskyist. There was United for Peace and Justice. Their leadership came out of the Communist Party USA or the Committees for Correspondence for Democracy. and socialism, which was a break off from the Communist Party in the early 1990s, and then they reconciled later. A lot of the leaders had also had previous experience in Line of March, which was part of the new Communist Party building movement coming out in the 1970s. Another formation was ANSWER, which was a front group for Workers' World Party, which is nominally, it came out of Trotskyism, but it basically became Stalinist, ironically, and it's known as campist. In other words, it sees the world as divided into the imperialist camp and anti-imperialist camp. So anyone that the U.S. opposes, they would put in the anti-imperialist camp. And they tend to be, to this day, pretty sectarian, but they led ANSWER. And that broke off and created a new organization called Party of Socialism and Liberation. Then there was the Campus Anti-War Network, which was basically a front group for the Internationalist Socialist Organization. And then the Revolutionary Communist Party had these various front groups, a Maoist organization. Refuse and Resist was one of the significant ones. And so this is kind of an expression of that older form of politics, where you're bringing together hundreds, like UFPJ claimed it had 1,400 different groups under its banner, but they were really about 20 or 30 that played a significant role in terms of shaping the actions. And so they, even though these Leninist and Trotskyist organizations, like, they really only had cadre in the hundreds, some like low hundreds, some maybe high hundreds, but it would be a stretch to say any had like 1,000 cadre, yet they were able to bring millions of people out on the street. And this is really important, that cadre organizations just punch above their weight extraordinarily. They can be authoritarian, they can be hidebound, they can be sectarian, but they have a discipline and a strategy and an ability to mobilize and create unity through action that really puts to shame any organizing that you see today.
And yet the kind of organizing that you write really characterized particularly the first quarter of the 21st century, but we can see it dating back to formations, say, with the Clamshell Alliance, the anti-nuclear movements of the 70s that organized around affinity groups, a kind of more horizontalist way of organizing, that some of that was also in response to the sectarian party-building politics of these tiny groups, which, you know, burned a lot of bridges within the left. So in a sense, while they may have coexisted, to at least to some degree, one was a reaction to the other.
I think that's a very important point you raise, that, you know, there's a tendency to think of the 70s as just dominated by just hundreds of these, like, kind of sectlets running around, each one thinking that they have the program for proletarian revolution. But we do see, you know, a whole new form of organizing. And my understanding is a lot of that also has to like when you talk about Clamshell Alliance and things like that, it was heavily influenced by second wave feminism consciousness raising movement, where again, kind of that affinity based and horizontalist to a degree.
Sure, and actually quite a few of those things also came out, ironically, of the Quakers, you know, that these kind of hallmarks of how people in Occupy, who I think often saw these as sort of anarchist traits, were actually, you know, the twinkling and so on, ways of expressing applause without noise. Actually, some of these came out of, as you say, second wave feminism, but also the Quakers. And so, as you've been describing, there are these different currents on the left. And I guess I would also mention that during the period that you've been describing, there was also more broadly the waning of mass membership-based movements and their replacement by a lot of nonprofit groups that saw themselves as progressive, including in United for Peace and Justice, whatever the leadership's orientation. So many, as you have indicated, of the groups within the umbrella of United for Peace and Justice in their organizing against the Iraq War were really lots of little organizations without any members, maybe nonprofits with a staff of three people.
That would be big, actually, if they had a staff. A lot of them were all volunteer organizations. The thing about the global justice movement and the Iraq anti-war movement, I think that's very important to remember, is both of them captured lightning in a bottle, right? No one expected November 30th, 1999 to go down like it did, where you had thousands of people in the street peacefully blockading and shutting down the ministerial. And, you know, there was a lot of police violence over the next few days. Seattle basically suspended the U.S. Constitution and declared protests illegal. But it basically put steel in the spine of delegates from the Global South who stood up to the U.S. and Bill Clinton and basically refused to pass a global free trade deal. And that eventually led to the killing of the whole WTO and that round of talks. Whereas with United for Peace and Justice, you know, they were able to bring together masses of people. Now, there were these huge marches. It felt like, you know, they were happening like two or three times a month by UFPJ and ANSWR, you know, where hundreds of thousands of people were coming out on the streets. And it led to the crescendo of February 15th, 2003, where millions of people in the U.S. and tens of millions of around the world. And it's very important. We really need to know this history, because I've seen so many people say, oh, No Kings was the biggest protest day in history. And I'm like, really? I mean, like, you really have a poor understanding of history if that's your claim. Because, okay, maybe there were more people out in the United States on the No Kings Day that happened on June 14th, I think, than there was on February 15, 2003. But there were more people out on the streets for the George Floyd movement, many more. Occupy, there were, I think, many more Occupy groups. And with both Occupy and George Floyd, no one was counting. The whole thing about the No Kings march, it really has a corporate form. It's franchised. You're counting places. You're counting people. You have this messaging. And it's just like, I'm not like criticizing people who went out. I think it's always good to go out and protest, but you need to do it with open eyes. And so let's talk about this third phase, which is by 2011 with Occupy, you start to see that is the birth of this new phase where it's viral, it's meme driven, it relies on social media. And so Occupy really had nothing behind it whatsoever. You know, there was all this kind of like things in the air, right? Obviously, you had the dramatic revolutions in Tunisia and Egypt, the Arab Spring. It was a moment of great hope. Then there was the, I think, kind of like a little hyperbolic name, the Wisconsin Uprising, where you have these mass protests against a right-wing governor, Scott Walker, who's essentially trying to crush the labor movement. Then in Europe, you also have the Indignados in Spain and Syntagma Square in Greece. And there's also things going on in New York City. There was this proto-occupation in I think it was 2010, called Bloombergville. There was these kind of mobile occupations going on in the spring, and there's like various calls to occupy Wall Street coming from U.S. Uncut and other small groups. And then it's Adbusters who comes in, and they've set the date. They create this poster of the ballerina on the bull with these like figures in black who could be riot police, who could be anarchists charging out of smoke. And, you know, they call for Occupy Wall Street. And I was down there from day one, and there were just maybe about like 40, 50 people spread out in Zuccotti Park, which is for New York City a pretty big plaza. So it didn't look like that many people. It was overwhelmingly white men. And I likened it to Close Encounters of the Third Kind. No one could actually explain why they were there camping out. They were drawn to it, like, you know, in Close Encounters, they're drawn to these various characters are drawn to the mountain. And I talked to people who had come from California, Texas, as well as the New York metropolitan area. And but what this does is it starts to like create this whole new form of protest. Now, the old form doesn't go away. In some ways, it merges with this new form. And I think we especially see it with the Palestine Solidarity Movement, and the anti-genocide movement that began after the genocide of Gaza, Israeli genocide of Gaza began on October 7th, 2023, because you see kind of like all these older groups, like, you know, there's Students for Justice in Palestine, there's Jewish Voice for Peace that were both started in the mid-1990s. This was a time, if you were political, it seemed like nothing was going on. There's also other groups that have played leading roles the last 2 years have been the Palestine Youth Movement, American Muslims for Peace, U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. There's also Jewish-led organizations such as If Not Now and Jews for Racial and Economic Justice. Jewish Voice for Peace is the only one that is explicitly anti-Zionist. And then there's veteran anti-war groups also involved in the anti-genocide movement, such as the Fellowship of Reconciliation and the American Friends Service Committee. But this all came together in this viral moment after October 7th, you know, Hamas attacks that many criticized, but I think a lot of people saw as a liberation, a prison break. And I think legitimately so, they interpreted that way. But, you know, the Israeli response has just been absolutely horrific. And the Western response in terms of enabling this genocide is utterly appalling.
And Arun will return in a moment to situating the Palestine Solidarity Movement in this longer scope. I should say I'm speaking with investigative journalist Arun Gupta about the protests of the last quarter century. And I wonder if, before talking more about the movements of the very recent past, you can talk a bit more about Occupy Wall Street, which, you know, you said you were there from day one and you co-founded the Occupied Wall Street Journal. And of course, these protests that were horizontal in organizational form, very much oriented around the spectacle, also characterized, I think, the George Floyd protests. And I wonder if you could talk about what you think of as the strengths and the weakness of this kind of form, one which, you know, although the left, as you've already illustrated, has been focused for a long time on spectacles in the media, the rise of social media has played an important role in fueling a certain way of mobilizing people in a more diffuse manner. You know, looking at your experience in Occupy Wall Street, you were also there when protests continued following the George Floyd upheaval in Portland and Trump sent in the federal troops. What are your reflections on the way that form has emerged, how it works most effectively, and how it doesn't?
People have likened what we're living through now as a second Gilded Age. None of us lived through the first, so I think in some ways it's hard to compare the two, you know, because we don't know exactly what it was like on the ground, and there's also major differences where there's the specter of nuclear war that's been hanging over humanity now for 80 years. You know, you and I live in the only country in the world that has used nuclear weapons, particularly against civilians, and the catastrophic climate change, as well as it's kind of fascism reloaded that we are now living under. The wealth has gotten ever more extreme, and So there is just this kind of like mass of anger, this just like boiling, burbling, anger that is out there. And what Occupy did is it really crystallized it. It provided almost this like lens that was a focal point. And it took all this anger and it was able to direct it against who were the real criminals in this story, with the Great Recession that Wall Street basically caused in 2007 and 2008 with just epic, massive multi-trillion dollar fraud with the housing market. And these occupations, and the one in New York City, we don't really have time to get into it, but it was very fragile. And it really what caused it to explode in growth was two incidences of police violence. One was, so Occupy was set up on September 17th on a Saturday, exactly 1 week later, September 24th. Police pepper sprayed a young woman standing on a sidewalk near Union Square. That went viral. It caused Occupy to explode in size in New York City. I'd been going down every day, and there was a it had grown to a few hundred, but then by Monday, now there was a couple of thousand people down there, and there's all these celebrities who are starting to show up. Then the following Saturday again. There's a march on the Brooklyn Bridge where the police, it looks like, led them into a trap. They appear to lead the protesters onto the roadway and then they kettle them and arrest 700 people. That becomes national and Occupy explodes around the country and the world. Something like 300 camps were recorded as being set up, but there were thousands and thousands of Occupy groups. My partner Michelle Fawcett and I, we covered Occupy for a year, and when we were going through like these deep red states, like Wyoming and Oklahoma and Alabama, people were telling us about like Occupy groups no one even knew about in these tiny little towns. So no one knew quite how big it was. And I'm also just going to mention her documentary on Occupy Wall Street will be coming out this September. So keep an eye out for it. But in any case, Occupy was able to like create this momentum. The occupation itself, people I think often misinterpreted it as a tactic, whereas the occupation was actually the strategy because the occupation created the people, it created the community. And one of the things it did very successfully when we're talking about the potential of horizontalism, it really did make everyone equal. Equal, right? If you go into left spaces, you need to have read all this theory, all this history, you need to know this jargon, you need like to know the right way to act. It's actually very exclusionary, very elitist, and can be very alienating. And there isn't like a good reflection of how the left really builds in these kind of exclusionary practices. But with Occupy Wall Street, because you're kind of creating this communal village, it brings in all sorts of people who have different practical skills to offer, like how do you survive in the cold? What do you eat? How do you do first aid? It also gave a lot of worth to people who were unhoused. And you saw a lot of unhoused people come into these camps who were able to contribute fully and join the occupation. But on the flip side, then in many cities, we saw it, places like Detroit and Austin and many other cities, they essentially became social service camps because the occupations were also a safe space where people knew they could come. They weren't going to be harassed by cops, or it's less likely they were going to be harassed. They could find warm food to eat, a safe place to sleep. There was activities going on. But in other places, the occupations, like when I came to San Francisco, we came to San Francisco in December 2011. We were warned by local activists, don't go in there because it had basically become like a shooting gallery in terms of heroin use. Seattle also had an element of that to itself. And the police started using this to their advantage. You know, the police have nothing to do with public safety. There was a good report in by the Daily News in New York City about how the police were actually directing homeless people, directing basically corner drug dealers to go down to Occupy Wall Street. And you know, this is not surprising, but it's incredibly disturbing. And I was consistently getting reports from across the country, none that I could confirm, of police dumping like homeless people or people with socialization or mental health issues off at different Occupy encampments. And so a lot of them just ended up devolving into like, how do you keep this village going? And even after the big occupations were all ousted, like, you know, New York, Oakland, LA, DC, Boston, etc., in the spring of 2012, Michelle and I, we were going around the country, and we were still finding that actually in small towns, they were, or smaller cities, there were occupations going on, but they had really just. So, for instance, in Little Rock, there was actually quite a robust occupation going on, but it was basically people who had no political experience, so they didn't really know what they were doing. Their only political activity was to print out move on petitions and hang out on street corners to try and get people to sign them. But they had a great like occupation with like showers, a bus, a music tent, and all that. Or in Salt Lake City, it really just kind of devolved into drifters who had chased everyone else away, and it was really just kind of like sad and ramshackle. So the problem with Occupy Wall Street is it had no organization behind it, and it really did not create much organization. There was a lot of co-optation that went on, but and you did have all these projects that came out of Occupy Wall Street. You had Occupy Our Homes that was, you know, modestly successful in terms of defending against home foreclosures. Maybe they prevented 100 or 200 home foreclosures across the country, but the state would respond very aggressively, slapping people with felonies for just simple, like, kind of nonviolent blockading. There was Occupier Banks that was kind of ill-conceived. They were like trying to essentially create a crisis at Bank of America, and it didn't last long. There were some labor organizing projects, small labor organizing projects. The most successful project to come out of Occupy Wall Street was the debt strike. They're the ones who really helped to make the issue of student debt a national issue and won limited relief finally under President Biden. But of course, Trump just came in and completely overturned that. The bigger significance of Occupy was it created space for Bernie Sanders, and it led to really just his shocking success in 2016. I would argue also that Trump himself is kind of post-Occupy because he certainly used the anger against elites, against the states, to his advantage. But with Bernie Sanders, you get his campaign, which which shocked even himself. He did not think he was going to do that well, and he nearly won, obviously, the Democratic presidential primary. But then that and Trump's victory led to the explosive growth of the Democratic Socialists of America, which led to AOC and the Squad, and then kind of this revitalization of socialism among like a whole new generation. And now we see with Zoran Mamdani, apparently his primary victory in New York City, which is just absolutely astonishing and exhilarating. But at the same time, I don't think the left is in any way prepared for just the master class in ruling class power they are about to, that's going to come down on them like a thousand tons.
Arun Gupta, so you're kind of tracing several different things and sort of sorting out what comes out of what and their interaction or difference is obviously complicated, but I think you're also arguing that this is history we really should know to understand the protest movements of the present, the potentialities, the pitfalls, and so on. And what you have been pointing to is a form of organizing which Occupy really epitomized, but we have seen again, we saw with the mass George Floyd protests, where viral images can spark mass mobilization, but don't necessarily lead to a kind of deeper organization. And so to take this to the more recent present, as you were mentioning a few minutes ago, in 2023, and then especially spring of 2024, we saw in this country mass protests on campuses against U.S. complicity and the complicity of academic institutions in the genocide that Israel has been meting out in Gaza. And then this explosion of protest, again, in many ways drawing on the model of Occupy, certainly in terms of encampments, you know, other ways that it's also different. And as you said, of course, anti-Zionist organizing didn't just appear last year, that going back three decades and further, but especially in the last three decades, a kind of mounting kinds of organizing around opposing apartheid in Israel-Palestine. And I wanted to ask you, how do you assess at this point the kind of organization that took place and has taken place within the Palestine Solidarity Movement, which of course received enormous amounts of repression from liberal institutions, which really paved the way for the repression that we have seen around Palestine with Trump, given the wider array of forces very powerfully mobilized against it?
It's a hard question to answer. Certainly, I think one is just practically, there is a lot of just utter despair over the fact that no one imagined that the genocide would be going on this long, or, you know, just the depths. And, you know, what we've seen in the last month or so are these massacres now that are happening daily at the aid distribution sites. Like, for anyone following it, every single day there's 20, 50, 100 people killed just trying to get aid. It is just utterly, like, mind-numbing, like, what is going on. And I think this is not to absolve Trump. He is a fascist. He's fine with genocide, or to absolve the Israelis. But none of this would be happening if not for the Democratic Party. And that was a huge problem, I think, for the Palestine Solidarity Movement. And I think they made big inroads in terms of, like, putting the Democratic Party on the defensive. But in the end, the Democratic Party under Biden and then Harris showed they were more committed to perpetrating the genocide than they were to stopping fascism. You know, in the end, Kamala Harris did end up saying she would end the war, except it was too little too late. She went to Michigan 2 days before the election and told a largely Arab American audience she would end the war. She needed to have said that 3 months earlier, because she was committed to the genocide. That certainly cost her Michigan, almost certainly cost her Wisconsin. When you look at how many young voters were disgusted by the Democrats' complicity, students and the Muslim population, and it may have cost her Pennsylvania as well. But in any case, this, I think there was explosive growth in various groups like Students for Justice in Palestine, Jewish Voice for Peace. We saw all these large marches, all these large actions for the first, like, you know, maybe 6 months, and then culminating in the student protests. But since the student protests, things have largely been quiet. I think if there is any bright spot, it's that, Mamdani won in a city where there's something like 1.3 million Jewish Americans, 1.617, say about 15% of New York City is Jewish, and he ran explicitly condemning the genocide, and he was able to win. And as one friend put it to me, not that it should matter, but he's Jewish, anti-Zionist. He's like, I think people are just sick and tired of Zionism and Israel, and that's the kindest way of putting it. The problem after the student encampments, I tried to keep in touch with people in terms of what was going on this previous fall, 2024, and it wasn't a pretty picture. One, university administrators at 100 different universities and colleges put in very repressive measures over the summer. And secondly, a lot of this campus organizing kind of devolved into, and this is typical of the left, kind of this more revolutionary than thou, ultra leftist, uncompromising, everyone's a sellout except those who take the most militant positions. So there was some good protesting that was going on this last academic year, but I think people certainly were discouraged, and now we also have just this incredible repression, the combination of fascism and these liberal institutions really just making protests almost impossible on college campuses, which is just really disheartening because that's where people used to learn to protest, or a lot of people at least cut their teeth on learning protests, learning tactics, learning the history. So, we're in a dark moment in many ways, but one glimmer of hope is Mahmoud Khalil, after being released from essentially being taken hostage for over 100 days, he went straight to the gates of Columbia University and led a protest there, calling them out for their support for genocide. So if he can keep at it, we should be able to as well.
Let me ask you more about the, remarkable news from last week about Democratic Socialist Zohran Mamdani's victory in the Democratic primary for mayor of New York. You were talking about the Democratic Party, and of course, there's always been enormous debate around how the left should relate to the Democratic Party. It's been a place where many energies on the left have been spent, many progressive hopes have gone to die. With the really striking victory of Mamdani, at least over Andrew Cuomo. Of course, this does not mean that he will end up being the mayor of New York. One just has to think of how, I think it was 2021, India Walton, a Democratic socialist and nurse, won the Democratic primary for mayor in Buffalo, New York, and then was defeated in the general election by the combined forces of the Democratic and Republican establishments. But with this victory now, one imagines that there will be even more pushes for Democratic socialists to run. And certainly, given how discredited the Democratic Party is, there is certainly appeal of candidates who are to the left within that spectrum. Tell us why, when you sort of survey all this, why it concerns you, as I'm pleased as I'm sure you are about Mamdani's victory, that in terms of a longer-term strategy, this is, in your words, winning power but not building power.
Yeah, I mean, I'm absolutely ecstatic. It's electrifying. It's amazing that he won. I mean, we should all just take a moment and be like, just wow, this is remarkable. But, part of the reason he was able to win, and again, it goes back to Occupy Wall Street with that kind of spatial rupture, right? Where protesting used to be in rooms among organizations in the streets, now it's digital. He was great on social media, the memes, the virality of his content. And it's also, let's not lose sight of the fact that the medium he was really using was TikTok. I'll just make a quick point about that. Everyone should be on TikTok. It's You know, yeah, sure, social media is crap, but TikTok is the best. It has the best political content. It's like got lots of great left-wing stuff, and I'm shocked at like how few people really over 30 I find are on TikTok. And that's what really helped power him to victory. Obviously, he's very charismatic, very quick on his feet. He really fought in the trenches really hard, just going out all over the city to win this. But the left has not built any sort of dual power. And frankly, and I've been in conversation with dozens of people within DSA, Democratic Socialists of America. They're not an organization in terms of their organizing. They are really kind of doing electoral politics for the left wing of the Democratic Party. And to really win significant radical change, we're not even talking revolutionary, but we start to chip away at the structures underpinning global capital, you need to build dual power. And no one is building dual power. And certainly DSA is not doing that. There isn't these mass base workers movement, that are consciously a class in and of itself that we saw a century ago. There's not like dense networks of community organizations. Most of their work is electoral politics. I get their I live in New York City. I get their emails, and it's about like get out the vote stuff, door knocking, canvassing, and what we're going to see is all the forces of capital are just going to absolutely come in and they're going to unite, right? And so we already saw that this with the primary, where you had like quote unquote liberal mega billionaires like Michael Bloomberg giving $8 million to Cuomo, who forget about the stuff, him being disgraced, who's just like a terrible right-wing politician. Capital will put up someone to run as an independent. And now Mamdani is not just facing Democratic Party voters, he's also facing all the right-wing voters in New York City. And we have to remember that Donald Trump won about a third of New York City in 2024, that he had been steadily increasing his vote totals over the last 8 years. So you have this huge constituency who will absolutely vote against Mamdani. What I'm more concerned about is kind of the AI viral disinformation. Instagram, I've been paying a lot of attention to it, the reels that people see on Facebook. If you do play around with the algorithm, it is an absolute sewer of neo-Nazi, vicious white supremacist content. And a lot of it is AI, a lot of it is fake, a lot of it, and we are going to see all sorts of dirty tricks against Mamdani. You're also going to see a united front among the media, the New York Times, the New York Post, all the financial media, all the broadcast media are going to be coming down on him. And even if he is elected, he then is going to face a very hostile a Democratic Party. Even when Bill de Blasio won, who was nominally a progressive, but he was a Democratic Party politician, Cuomo was a governor, he was extremely hostile to de Blasio. If Mamdani wins, you're going to see a Democratic Party that wants to destroy him, and they're going to try and undermine all his signature policies about free childcare, free buses, city-owned grocery stores, affordable housing. They're not going to play ball with him. The police are basically going to tell, I'm putting this in a very polite manner, tell him to go take a long walk off a short pier. The real power in New York City is the NYPD. Michael Bloomberg used to boast it's the seventh largest standing army in the world. The left has not built the sort of dual power it needs to really confront Capitol and the forces that are going to be arrayed against.
Much of the real resistance that we've seen to Trump in the last several months, from immigrants and their relatives and their coworkers, organizing against ICE abductions in their workplaces and in their neighborhoods. Where do you situate, as we end this conversation, such resistance in your taxonomy of recent protests and organizing? And are there lessons that you would draw from what we have seen so far?
These are people and communities who are literally fighting for their lives. I've done a good bit of reporting along the border on both sides of the border and a lot about refugees and immigrants. And deportation is a death sentence. A lot of people who are deported, especially men, I've been to Tijuana, there's just like armies of deported men who become homeless, and they don't survive long on the streets of Tijuana, especially between a predatory police and predatory cartels who work kind of hand in hand with the complicity of the state. But even if you don't wind up on the street, your life expectancy is almost certainly going to be shortened. These immigrant communities, or ones that have been here 2-3 generations, there is a shared kind of cultural, linguistic affinity. So this harkens back to an older style of organizing that we were talking about. I think especially in California, you've seen militant left wings in these communities. And then a lot of we can call kind of more the white left, white progressives. I think it's a real problem. And this is what I was saying about DSA. Like, I've actually had DSA members tell me, if you look at their website, you would never know that Trump is happening. And DSA, again, this is putting it kindly, keeps sitting out these moments of mass upsurges. They sat out George Floyd. They sat out Gaza. And I keep hearing the excuse, well, chapters and individuals can do stuff, and they are doing stuff. I'm like, that's not a socialist organization. The whole point of having a national socialist organization is unity in action, that you can create a strategy, understand you have tens of thousands of members, and you can leverage that, you can punch above your weight, right? I was describing these cadre organizations with few hundred members that were able to put millions of people out on the street. And this is, this is a much longer conversation, but DSA is essentially a get out the vote operation for the left wing of the Democratic Party. They're not a militant mass-based organization in the working class, in communities that are looking to radically shift the whole social structure, not just politics, but the whole of society in a more emancipatory, revolutionary manner. And you can say it is what it is, but it's a problem when we're staring, this fascism in the face, where ICE is literally playing the role of a Gestapo. There's no way we get out of this mess without really going back to basics, like building local, regional, and national organizations that we can use in this digital landscape.
Arun Gupta, we're entirely out of time. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me today.
Arun Gupta is an investigative journalist who is co-founder of The Independent and the Occupied Wall Street Journal. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time.